Segundo here, and I happen to believe that Sarah Manguso is wrong to suggest that there are only two kinds of decay. I can easily name 57 kinds without thinking too much, and I don't even have an unclassifiable neurological condition.
Okay, so I'm here with Sarah Manguso, who is the author most recently of The Two Kinds of Decay. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
First off, I wanted to start off and ask you about the short paragraphs within this particular book. It reminded me very much of a David Markson novel to some degree. I'm wondering if you started off with these sentences in another format. Did you have 3x5 cards? What was your relationship to this text on a word level? How did this arrangement of white space between little trajectory points come to be?
Well, let me begin by thanking you for the compliment of being compared to Markson, who's one of my greatest living heroes.
Yeah.
He's the writer I most recently sent a fan letter to.
He writes back, too.
He does, yeah. Everyone does, I find. Yeah. No one's ever failed to write back to me. But that's another question. The paragraphs you mention, I don't know actually whether they are technically paragraphs, and I don't know what to call them. I always have a problem with nomenclature because the things I write aren't, they don't really fit formally into genre as easily as one would like. And they are definitely made of sentences, though. That's something I can get behind.
We could call them units. We can call them umlauts, you want to call them.
There's the word chunk, but that shouldn't be used to describe anything
thingies.
Except vomit. Right, yeah, things. I don't know. But it is true that I didn't write the book in order, one, chunk by chunk or sentence by sentence. I actually wrote the first draft as a collection of one-page things, pages, individual pages, and each page was titled as the chapters are now titled, and they weren't written in any particular chronology. They weren't written in, after any particular theme. I was just remembering, I tried to remember 1,000 words worth of memory per day, and that added up to between 1 and 5 vignettes, and that's how the book was written. The first piece that I wrote was The Signet, which is now kind of, I think, somewhere in the second half of the book. And I don't remember what the last piece that I wrote was, but I really just made them higgledy-piggledy as I made my prior books, which were all collections. They weren't about, any one unified thing.
Now, of this 1,000 words a day, I'm sure that a lot was pared down. Did you have any particular prioritization system for which sentences or which words or which units or thingies, as we're sort of suggesting here, made it into the book? I mean, how was the arrangement process? It seems to me that the book functions in many ways as a timeline of a particular period in your life. And I'm wondering how you lined up particular thingies, for lack of a better unit, in this particular book. I mean, what struck you as a this is the sentence, this is the one that's got to go into the particular book, this is the particular wisdom or specific imagery or metaphor that it must be placed in tandem with the other thingy?
Mm. Well, I guess I thought of the pieces as an arrangement in two phases. One, the first phase was completely chaotic, and the second phase was orderly. And during the chaotic first draft phase, the project that I set myself was really just to try to remember everything I could remember about this 9-year period of my life. Just everything, every individual memory that I could bring up. And after my latest remission had lasted 7 years, and after that time, it really did seem that the memories had become particulate. Like there really was just one memory that espoused the insertion of the central line, my first central line in my chest, and that really, it really did kind of seem to have hardened in my memory into this item, this thing, this chunk, this chapter.
Yeah.
And so, while I was first writing the book, I didn't think about chronology, mainly because I had no idea how to write a book about one thing. I'd never done it before, and I didn't know anything about narrative or what should come first. I wrote the pages all as individual files, and once I couldn't remember anything else, I printed them all out, and then tried to notate, based on memory and based on asking people what month and what year each thing had happened.
Yeah.
And then I just put them in chronological order.
Well, there's specific phrasing for some of these thingies. Pardon, I just
Let's
love saying thingies.
Let's call them chapters now. I think that sounds more professional.
Or these particular word arrangement units. WOWs.
WANs. Oh, yeah.
WOWs. WOWs.
I'm going to call them chapters.
Fair enough.
But I like WOW.
But you often have, for example, text within text with this italicization. But you have a particular timeline because you often use the day before the decision I wrote, or I wrote this 3 months after the diagnosis. And so it seems that not only arranging these wows into themes, but also a timeline, I'm wondering whether you place prioritization upon a theme over a timeline. Were there certain circumstances? Was this entirely an organic process? Or was there just a lot of tinkering around with order and with rhythm with this, you know, the way we were talking about this, it almost seems like this, you know, quarto of some sort.
Well, I wish I knew. I'm not really sure what how to differentiate an organic process from an inorganic process.
Okay. Let's say kind of blindly intuitive versus carefully planned and calculated.
Well, I mean, at the risk of sounding difficult, I'm really trying my best to remember what it was like to write this book. But I made the thing, and the thing is a result of my guiding intelligence engaged with my memory, and I don't know that I can really distinguish between the decisions that were more intellectual than intuitive or more intuitive than intellectual. I wish I knew. It is true that after the book was done, or after the final draft was done, it did seem that there were themes that had been inserted or injected into the book by some planning mechanism that I didn't really recognize, but I think that's kind of a familiar, recognition to have after you make a thing. It makes sense in ways that you weren't exactly planning.
Yeah.
I'd rather not say that the whole thing is mysterious to me, but I think enough of it is that I'm hesitant to kind of say, well, I meant to do this, this, and this. I don't know what I really meant.
Well, I mean, how much should we really be dwelling upon dichotomies, whether it be intellectual versus emotional, or, I mean, because I'm tempted to do that because, not just because the book is called The Two Kinds of Decay, but also because of this text within the text scenario, which allows you to not only pinpoint how you were actually applying text onto paper at a particular point in your life, and now we're essentially looking back years later and looking at that act of text onto paper, and then you are in turn putting the text onto paper. And so this is something that always intrigues me with any particular book, whenever an author does this, in terms of pinpointing and arranging and the like. I mean, that's a lot of thoughts to throw at you, but I want to ask whether the arrangement process were you thinking of the reader at any point within this arrangement process,
or was it
a matter of just subjecting this history you had and figuring it out and letting it kind of go off into the world and letting it find readers later?
Oh, well, I think I understand that. I was always thinking of the reader. I mean, the reader's the main thing here. I'm not really interested in making mysterious books that make sense to no one, including myself. I'm deeply interested in making something that's understandable by other people, and to have the audacity to even think that I can communicate this collection of feeling and memory and thought to other people in the same form that I experience it. It's that's the whole thing. And so I really am always thinking about whether the thing that I am writing is clear or would be clear to somebody else reading. I was sort of lost in the internet. I think it was yesterday, and I was reading about somebody's editing process. Might have been Adam Thirlwell, and he was talking about the nice and good. The nice and good phase of his editing.
Have you read The Elements of Style yet?
Haven't read it yet, but
it's
I do own it.
Yeah.
Yes, people are fascinated by it.
People are either really appalled by it or really fascinated by it. I'm more in the fascinated camp.
I can't wait to read it. But the nice and good phase, if it is Adam Thirlwell's, now I think it's actually somebody else's, is the phase toward the end of editing in which every adjective that is synonymous with a simpler adjective, like nice or good, is taken out and replaced with the words nice and good. And I definitely spent most of my close editing time doing things like that, really just taking out any syntactic barrier to sense. So in that way, yes, I'm always thinking of the writer. I think that was about 1/16th of your original question.
That's okay. It was more of an observation, I suppose, than a question. That's a problem of mine. I wanted to ask you about the idea, while we're on this subject of syntactic barriers and the like, about how you foreshadow meaning or rules. For example, I was taken with what you wrote of the nurse. You write, like all good nurses, she understood that inserting a bullet of hardened gel into someone's rectum was just another thing that had to be done, no more or less willingly than picking up a dropped rubber glove or stripping a bed after someone died in it. Now, this seems to also foreshadow the way that you dealt with your own disease and what you say about decay later on in the book, and what you also say about suffering and paying attention. The idea of this book, the overarching theme to me at least, was this notion of, yes, you must carry on doing things, you must carry on sometimes having hobbies if need be. I'll talk to you about hobbies in just one sec, but I wanted to ask you, when this particular theme announced itself to you during the act of arrangement and the act of syntactic shifting about.
I'm sorry, which theme?
This theme of
carrying on,
and doing things and paying attention and the like. That's the overarching idea that I think unifies both sections of the book.
Well, I think that's the main question, isn't it? Because I would agree with you, or I would agree with what you're suggesting here, that the book is about, you know, a disease that I came down with and dealt with and recovered from, but it's almost that's the conditional subject, or that's the incidental subject of the book, whereas the real subject of the book was the experience of this narrator, who happens to be me, of learning how to pay attention. And I was not aware that would wind up being the overarching theme of the book. And in fact, I should say that it was several months before, well, maybe that's exaggerating, but it was a while before I even thought of the book as being having the possibility of the form that would need an overarching, you know, sense. It really just seemed like a bunch of mosaic tiles for a while, because that's all that I could imagine, you know, myself capable of. And it turns out it is all I'm capable of, but these mosaic tiles all happen to be about, you know, the same thing. Or they're in the same frame. I don't know. But it did become clear that moment, that vignette, that chapter that I think is called Attention, about a day where really nothing happened. I got an infusion. That was really it. It was a 15-hour infusion or a 12-hour. That was a good centerpiece, because it limited content to the point that I felt I could really understand what was going on. I think my entire process of writing and living and sort of, you know, coping with being alive is cutting down content so we can see the thing at all. That's how Sontag said it.
Well, this embracing of life, it's interesting to me in terms of what you have described as to how this book came about, it's almost as if I suppose that you wanted to, being a poet, throw yourself into this wild anarchy of a particular time, the notion of wandering through life and being unaware of the many metaphors that announce themselves to us. Was this one of the reasons why you sat down to have 1,000 words of your life a day, 1,000 words of memory, so you can actually filter out what worked best as a poetic metaphor, this filtering process?
Well, I'm a little insulted that you called me a poet.
Oh.
No, I'm
99.44%
kidding. Yeah, I don't know. I always felt kind of goofy calling myself a poet. But yeah, I mean, it is true that the main activity of my writing life for a long time was making poems. So I clearly need to deal with this in therapy or something. But as far as, finding 1,000 words of poetic metaphor a day, that wasn't how it felt. And that, I don't think I really wrote much metaphor, except incidentally. And I don't know, I mean, I guess I wrote about space every once in a while. That comes up a number of times in the book. But what I was attempting was just trying to write down what I remembered in such a way that the act of remembering didn't get in the way, and sort of, you know, the engine of my intelligence didn't get in the way. I don't mean intelligence like smartness, but intelligence, you know, just the part of the brain that works. And I wasn't really interested in metaphor at all. There's actually a passage where I'm writing about the treatment where my plasma is replaced entirely, which I had a lot, you know, 50 something times, I think. And I'm trying to come up with a metaphor to describe how it feels to have this room temperature solution pushed into your heart. And I don't. In the end, I just say, you know, forget the metaphor. It just feels like really cold stuff going to your heart for this amount of time at this rate. And, you know.
Well, I'll retract metaphor and let's just say meaning. I mean, okay. There is a certain metaphor to the uncertainty of a job that you frequently allude to throughout the book. Just by way of having this condition, you are unable to have a stable job anywhere, whether working in a bookstore or even the demands that the energy of a job will entail. But this is intriguing to me. It becomes metaphorical in my mind because this is something in which your own particular condition determines your own particular place in the world. I say to myself, well, no, this is more than just meaning. It's a profound connection that you are drawing upon your role in relation to that of the universe. So I don't quite buy I wasn't in it for the metaphors. Maybe extraordinary meaning could be the semantics we might use, but what of this? Where was the searching for meaning, and why reject metaphor when it seems to be quite evidently there in the text?
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree that it's there in the text. Of course it's there in the text. It's not a DAT recording of the 9 years. And so, you know, I have to use the crutch of metaphor. I guess I would have to use the crutch of metaphor even if I were capable of writing a reported story about, you know, something that's happening right now. But I was very self-consciously trying not to use metaphor. I tried to keep that out of my my hand as vigorously as I could. And I was interested in, you know, during the writing of it, before I was conceiving of it as a book, I was just interested in to what degree I was capable of just writing down the facts in a way that was compelling to me, at least, in the beginning. And I was interested by, you know, the challenge of not using exclamation points or line breaks. I wanted to empty my toolbox of everything except, you know, what I absolutely needed, like the alphabet and, you know, a conventional sentence structure and white space. Without white space, I don't know what I would do. I'd be out of a job. But
got it.
You know, despite the fact that the book certainly is got at least a metaphor a page, I tried my best.
Yeah.
I tried my best to leave them out.
I'm curious, there are two questions that seem to me related, but I'll just throw them both at you and see if we can come up with some two kinds of questions, I suppose. But I was curious how aware you made yourself of other illness memoirs. There are a number of them, certain staples, I suppose, that one runs the risk, I suppose, of writing any particular type of book and having to run into what else is out there. Was this a particular issue with you? And also, going back to this idea of trying to find some kind of meaning, or rather to memorialize your own consciousness, is this why you felt the need to dwell so much on other people in this book? Because dwelling on oneself after a time becomes almost solipsistic to some degree. I mean, it becomes something of a condition.
Are you saying
the book
isn't solipsistic?
Huh?
Are you saying my book isn't
solipsistic?
I'm actually delighted that you're saying that it doesn't seem solipsistic.
It does not seem solipsistic to me, but because you are in the act of trying to determine meaning. I don't necessarily see trying to find connections and things through oneself as a solipsistic act, but that's just me. It can be in certain voices and in certain tones, but I think because the purpose of the book seemed to me more of this idea of subconscious connection transmuting into, I guess, a cohesive idea of what the universe entails, I didn't see it so much that way. Mm. But I am curious
about the cohesive idea of what the universe entails. No, I that's great. That's exactly, can we pretend I said that? That's exactly what I was trying to do.
Okay. But in relation to other people,
yes,
and other
memoirs. Yes, the first part of your question.
Yeah, I'm curious if you can.
Yeah, that definitely is a little nervy. I am very well aware of the fact that I'm an upper middle class white woman living in Brooklyn, New York, and the book that I just wrote is about my disease and how I got to go to the hospital in a first world country, and you know, and oh, I suffered so much, but you know, I never was in a septic room, and I was never I never doubted that the health insurance would, well, actually I did doubt it, but you know, I had health insurance, and compared to the stories of people who grow up in war zones or have to fight wars or have to work in factories, or you know, the list goes on, and you know, I'm pretty much at the very upper tippy top of white privilege in this country and in the world, and so I'm aware of that every day of my life, and I'm also aware of that as I look at illness memoirs, which for the most part are written by upper middle class white women who have time to kind of, you know, think in their beautifully appointed writing studios with their Macintosh computers about that terrible time that's now over. And I don't know. I mean, I suspect that other memoir writers worry about that too. I mean, it's impossible to have a memoir marketed by one's publisher, if one goes with a commercial publisher, and not be forced or at least obliged to choose a subcategory. And so this is a memoir of illness. Whether or not I would say, you know, this is a memoir of illness, it's about the, you know, shocking story of my being paralyzed in a hospital, it brings up a lot of negative feelings. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that the book is that dissimilar to other books that I like that seem incidentally to be memoirs about illness. And I really loved Lucy Grayley's book, Autobiography of a Face, and I really loved Girl Interrupted, the book, not the movie. Both of those books were formally interesting, and I think they both used their subjects in the way that you just mentioned, as as, you know, means of exploring the cosmic oneness, or your phrase was better, but the books that kind of stop at reportage and use the illness as a subject in itself and as an end in itself, I think are less interesting. And so that's my roundabout way of saying that I think it's possible to write a compelling book about any subject, but unfortunately books need to be marketed, and the market wants to know what the book is about. You know, the market doesn't want to say, well, I'm going to sell you this book. It's not really about anything that I can say. It's about the process of remembering. I mean, that's unfortunately just not an option right now.
But we're talking about marketing after the fact. We're not talking about the more interesting question of actually writing the book, the subject of illness cropping up as a thematic unity by necessity, because that's how you lived your life. This goes back to my question of how much comparison between this book and other books weighed in your mind within the act of chronicling and the act of arrangement.
The sense I'm getting is that
I don't think it did.
No,
and
it really
the marketing
didn't.
After the fact.
It really didn't. Yeah, that's a really important observation you just made. It's true that while I was writing the book, I thought it wouldn't that be kind of a capitalist decision to think, well, I'm writing a book about illness, so I'd better write these other books that have been marketed as illness memoirs and either make them the same or make them different. I don't know. Whether or not it's a capitalist decision doesn't really matter. But, I as I was reading the book, I was reading other books, and I was listening to music and seeing films. I was watching Jem Cohen's films. I was listening to Godspeed You Black Emperor, and I was probably reading the Vice collection of 10 years of Do's and Don'ts by Gavin McInnes, which is one of my favorite contemporary books. And I've learned more about writing by reading that book than anything I can think of in the last couple of years. That guy, I hope he is understood better in the future than he is now. But I think he's absolutely a genius of the English language. And yet I wasn't trying to write like Gavin. I mean, of course I would love to be funnier, who wouldn't, but, as I wrote the book, I read and listened to and watched things that I found inspiring for various reasons. I find comedy very inspiring, but, I'm not often accused of being funny, so, there's gotta be some deeper inspirational process going on.
Got it.
Than imitation.
Well, some writers are terrified of this influence of other books and willfully blind themselves. Some authors I've talked to, like Kate Atkinson and Paul Auster, have told me that they cannot read fiction as they're writing fiction. Others can't live without it. Is this of a concern for you? Do you have no problems? It seems to me that that you are willing to essentially just submerge your mind and your senses with all manner of culture in the act of writing almost anything. Is there any distinction between your kind of culture ingestion as you're writing a book or as you're writing a particular poem or a short piece or a long piece versus not writing anything at all? Or?
That's a question I've been thinking about recently, actually, because I most recently I've decided that this new book I'm working on is a novel, and it's a novel about a prison, and so I thought maybe I should reread Falconer, Cheever's novel about a prison, and it was deeply depressing because it's, you know, one of the great short novels. I like short novels a lot. And I think, well, I'm in a funny situation here because of my books, I did not have a clear awareness of their genre or of their form while I was writing them, and so I didn't really feel oppressed by, you know, other novels, and that I wasn't really self-consciously writing a novel. I wasn't self-conscious of the fact that I was writing toward what would be eventually a memoir, and so I didn't feel oppressed by other memoirs. But this morning I was sort of looking at the novel, the thing, the book, and I think that
the collection of wows.
I don't know. But I think there is a real truth in that feeling of oppression and fear and anxiety of influence. And I think I will feel safer once I kind of flush the sense from my conscious mind that I'm working on a novel. And yeah, once it turns back into a thing or a collection of wows, I will feel better about it. I hope I do.
Do you have a title for this novel, or are you operating
yes.
in the... Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes.
So if you don't know whether it's a novel or a non-fictional reconstruction into fiction or a transmutation or just simply a book, you do at least have a title. So there is at least one identifying one.
Yeah, I can tell you the title. It's The Guardians. Uh-huh. And funny story, this is a title that was going to be the title of my third poetry collection, which was less a collection than a book-length poem. And I wrote this poem, and it was 80 pages at one point, and then I edited it down to about 10, and then published it in a journal, and then lost interest in it. So then I think I always loved the title, though. I mean, it made a lot of sense with what I was thinking about then, and now I'm thinking about completely different things. I'm trying to be less didactic than I was when I was writing only poetry. And now I have an idea about a story about surveillance and paranoia. And but as I said, I've really got to figure out a new way of dealing with it, because I feel too anxious about it right now.
I wanted to ask you again about hobbies. I had brought this up earlier, but did you make any additional attempt to have a alphabetical approach to hobbies at all? And also I wanted to ask about the idea of hobbies in relation to embracing life. You have the unnamed big name writer, or famous writer, as you say.
Well, I don't think this writer would mind being named. He's very good-natured. It's Edmund White.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, another hero. His memoirs... extraordinary. Yeah. My Lives. I think I may have read that while I was writing this. I hope it rubbed off on me. But yeah, he tells great stories, and he was the one who told the story about sitting on the airplane.
But to be clear, it alerts the listeners. Essentially, he's mystified when someone asks him what his hobby is, because writing is his occupation. And this seemed very interesting to me in light of how you approached the idea of taking up hobbies in an alphabetical manner. It's almost as if this situation is reflective of how much additional burdens we bring to life, and how essentially the so-called universal experience we have, the idea that we think that our particular trauma is applicable to almost any kind of circumstance, that the bundling of hobbies or other sorts of obsessions or issues only helps to feed that fire. What was I going with this? I think I wanted to get your thoughts on this, but I didn't have a way of quite coming at a question mark. So maybe I'll just...
That's okay. I can try to yap for a while, and you can find some sense in what I say. The chapter that you're referring to is called Hobbies, and it is true that while I was sick, I think after the first year, maybe after the first couple of years, I thought, you know, I really should have some hobbies, so... You know, people would say she's sick, but at least she has so many hobbies. You know, I thought that would sort of be a badge of being an interesting or an involved person. And I didn't get past the letter C. What was C? Oh, C was chess. Yeah, I was going to learn how to be a great chess player.
Did you remember what happened with the letter A after the book was done? Or?
I think it may have been, you know, I...
Accordions?
No, if
abstract
only.
Painting?
Well, I didn't have the finger strength to do either of those things, but I think it may have been...
Acapella?
No. Again, I didn't have the diaphragm strength. I got the annotated Alice, Martin Gardner's annotated edition of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland out of the library, and I may have wanted to write a paper about Alice in Wonderland. But I really like somebody else guessed that it was aphoresis, and I think that would have been a much, you know, funnier answer to the question.
Yeah.
But I lost interest in my project after the letter C got boring, and And I don't really think of hobbies in that way anymore. You know.
I'm wondering why you didn't try it the other way around. Z would have been a very tough sell there, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
Zoology, maybe.
See, it could be zoology or sleeping. You know,
zebra hunting or zebra stripes. I don't know.
I mean, there are a lot of ways that this book could be more interesting. But as I said, I was really just, you know, trying to get the facts right.
Well, Sarah, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Thanks. To coming down without a sound.